So we're going to continue today in Hebrews chapter 1, Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, as we're dealing with questions and as we're dealing with this series, if Jesus is the answer, what is the question? Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his power. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much better than the angels as he has inherited a more excellent name than they. So as we've been dealing with this idea, and as you've been hearing me say every Sunday with this series, is that Jesus is the answer to every question. Jesus is the answer to every dilemma, every situation, every problem. It always comes back to the person of Jesus. One of the things that is so captivating and is so powerful about Christianity is the idea that we believe in a person by the name of Jesus, who is God, who actually became man. And the reason that he became man was so that we could actually have relationship with God. The sacrifice that Jesus made is very intriguing because we think about the sacrifice and immediately we go to the cross. And yes, that was the ultimate sacrifice. That was the atonement. That was the that was him going on our behalf and taking our punishment for our sin. But one of the things that I always can't get away from is the idea of what sacrifice was it for Jesus to actually leave his throne and come to this earth. Think about that just for a moment, and we can't even fathom or even comprehend what type of a sacrifice that must have been for him to give up all of his godliness so that he could actually walk amongst sinful man and be surrounded by sin everywhere he went. And we learn from the book of Hebrews also that every temptation that he experienced is exactly the same as if you and I would have experienced it. So every time we see something that Jesus conquers, it isn't a situation of, well, he was the Son of God, so we see why. No, he was able to conquer it because he had the faith and the foundation of the Father giving him the strength to do so, which is what you and I can do as well, which makes this very, very convicting. Now, as we've been talking about this from the beginning here in verse 1, we're talking about the idea of God speaking and that God spoke through his forefathers and through the prophets at many times and in various ways. That was the first part. And then we move into the idea that, but now he has spoken to us by his son Jesus Christ. And his son wasn't just somebody who just appeared, but his son has been there from the beginning. His son Jesus Christ is eternal, which means, as they said, he was there at creation. Through him all things were made, through whom he created the world. We talked last week about that, meaning the idea of time and how God actually created time through Jesus. Very powerful, interesting concept when you think about what time, because we can't even imagine a world without time. We're always confined to time. Even when we tell ourselves we're not confined to time, we're still confined to time. No matter what, we're always confined to time because we're living in the world, but God is completely above that. And God sees things so much different than you and I do. God can see the end, he can see the middle, and he can see the beginning all at the same time. It's a powerful idea, powerful concept, isn't it? So what we learn from that is that he is the main source. He's the one that we should put our trust and faith in because of that. And now the writer of Hebrews goes on to explain and gives more details about the Son. Because he says in verse 2 that he has spoken to us in his Son, and he appointed this Son of heir of all things, which means Jesus is in charge and he's the source, through whom also he made the world. So he was there at creation. He created time. Verse 3, and he is the radiance of his glory. Now you think about that for a moment. He is the radiance of his glory. Now we see a lot of radiance this time of year, don't we? A lot of things are radiating around us. As I don't know if you have a tradition in your home, I have a tradition in ours. It's pretty much pushed by Miranda more than myself, but always let's pile everybody in the van and let's go drive around and look at Christmas lights, right? And we go around and we look at all the things that are radiating around. Some of them are really amazing. You guys have seen them. Some of them are really something when you can tune the radio station and the lights to time with the music. And some of you can get out of your car, you can walk through, they give you a tour. And you know, I always think when I see something that's huge, I always feel bad for their next door neighbor. Because, you know, the neighbor probably, you know, invested a little bit of time and some money. This year is going to be great, and I'm going to put up some lights, and it's going to be nice. And all of a sudden, this guy moves in next door, and boom, overshadows everything that you thought was important. I believe I shared with you one time back when I was a little bit into it. I've never really been into the decorating type of thing or the lights, but there was a season where I was into it a little bit, and I had a little bit of self-motivation. And so we had this house where we lived at the time, and it was kind of like an L shape, or actually a T shape if you looked at it from the sky, basically. So the house was like this, and then it had a room out front like this. So we had a front yard on this side and a front yard on this side. And so I would be out there and I would start radiating our yard. And I would put lights around the entire yard, all around the manger scene. I had an idea, and Miranda didn't like this idea very much. I said, all I need now is on the other side, this other front yard, is Herod sitting on his throne, staring, glaring back over on this side. You know, and not everybody liked that idea, so I never got the chance to do that. But it's interesting about radiating and the lights and all that. Now, how many people here like seeing Christmas lights radiating? How many people here like to make them radiate? Yeah, there's not very many. I've never met anyone who loves to put up Christmas lights. I dread it. If I forget a section and Miranda doesn't notice, it's fine. You know how many times you put them up, and you guys know the end of the story. You put up the Christmas lights, and what happens? You test them before you even put them up, and they work. Did you hear me say that? You test them before you put them up, and they work. Did you hear me say it? You test them, and you see every bulb is working. And then you get up on the ladder, and then you start clipping them on. And the weather's always great for this, too. The weather's never a problem because you have no problem with not having any feeling in your hands or anything like that when you're trying to clip them on correctly and get them on. And then you finally get them all done, and you plug them in. And then, of course, somehow something happened between when you tested them and when you put them up. Now, and the first thing that goes to my mind is, well, it's not too bad. We can just leave it just like that. That's not a problem. We don't need all of them lit, right? I mean, you know, 3/4 of them aren't lit. What's the big deal? Just focus on the quarter. That's fine, right? No, it never goes well that way. But you know, the whole idea of the radiating season, this is a radiating season. We have candles up here radiating. We have, you know, everywhere you look now, lights are radiating. And I want you to think about that, and the term is what the writer of Hebrews is saying. He is saying that Jesus is the radiance of his glory. The term radiance literally means to shine. Shine. Now, I haven't seen anybody this year yet. Maybe there's somebody here, but somebody usually comes in on the Christmas Sunday or Christmas Eve with something on them that lights up. I haven't seen anybody yet. Somebody has, oh, we do. Yes, we do have one. Yes. Can you plug it in now, or how do you do it? Hey, give her a hand. Wow. I knew there'd be one in the crowd, right? Now, there's a perfect illustration for what I'm talking about right there. See, now, she really is loving the idea that I pointed her out. I can tell you that. but she is shining right now, right? And she's very noticeable right now. And it's the same idea with Jesus. What he's saying is that when Jesus walked this earth, and when he returned, and when he was resurrected from the dead, that he still is the radiance. The term that he's using is in. is, not was. He is. So the time that he was here in the manger, the time that he grew up, the time that he was a teenager, the time that he walked with the disciples, the time that he was on the cross, the time that he was in the tomb, the time that he was resurrected, that entire time, Jesus was the radiance of God's glory. Which means God's glory was shining off of Jesus. Now think about that for a moment. If that's true, think about all of the people that rejected him. Think about all the people that said, you're not the Messiah, you're not God, there's no way you are. The writer of Hebrews is pretty much saying it was obvious to everyone around that the glory of God was shining off of him. So to reject that, somebody had to have something misunderstood or miscommunicated or something to actually reject it, especially when you go through the whole story, all the way up to the crucifixion, and everything that's happening in the crucifixion was prophesied about, that somebody should have spoke up and said, hey, you know what? I think we're wrong. I think this might be the Messiah. Well, how do you know? Well, look at all the scrolls that we study. It's all coming true. He is. He's the one. And so Jesus was radiating the glory of God. When you continue on to the next statement he makes about Jesus, he says he is the radiance of his glory, and he is the exact representation of his nature. The exact representation of his nature. Now, I want you to think about that concept for a moment, exact representation. Has anybody ever had to represent you before? Maybe they had to do something that you were supposed to do, but you were unable to do it, so you sent them to do it on your behalf. Now, when they do it, when they're representing you, they really aren't you, but they're just representing you. So you really can't say that that was an exact representation of you. It's more of a replica or something like that that is happening. But the only thing I could think about when I thought of this concept of an exact representation, the only thing I could think about was food. Now, I don't know why this season we always talk about food. Food comes up a lot. That's what everything's about, food. You know, I know the movie said if you build it, they will come, but I believe if you feed them, they will come. That's just the way it is. But food is interesting, isn't it? You go into a restaurant, and I don't care what restaurant it is. I don't care if it's fast food. I don't care if it's sit down. I don't care if it's dark. I don't care if it's light. I don't care. It doesn't matter. This is pretty much the truth in every experience I have ever had. When you order, they take the menus away. You ever wonder why they do that? Yeah, when you order, they take the menus away. Well, there's probably somebody else waiting so they can order. No. See, I have this whole theory down of why they take the menus away. Because what happens is when the food comes to your table, if you still have the menu, you can open up the menu and compare the picture to what they bring. And you can say, excuse me, I ordered this, but this is what came. As you can see, it's a little different. So what they do instead is they take it away so that you just, oh. And even if you think about it, you're like, well, maybe I saw the picture wrong, right? Now, I don't know of any time I've ever had one that actually matched up exact as an exact representation. It's funny when people talk about food, isn't it? And it's funny when people assume that they know what you like. How many people like it when somebody assumes what you like? Because I don't really care for that when somebody assumes what I like. You know, well, you probably would like this. No, you don't know me. You have no idea what I would like. But if especially this whole idea of, you know, well, you can try this. It tastes just like this. Now, I'm not against this. I will never be against this. I will never hold up a picket sign and go against this. But I am not in much favor about this impossible movement that's going on. That you can have an impossible Whopper. What does that mean? There's no meat in it. I even saw where the Dunkin' Donuts chimed in, and they have an Impossible sausage breakfast sandwich now. Everywhere I look is an Impossible, an Impossible, an Impossible. And I look at it and I say, you know, as a meat eater, I look at it and say, yeah, I can tell you one thing. It is Impossible. I'll tell you that. Why? Because I've tried some of those before. Now, they say this is different, and this is perfect, and it could be. I don't know. But I've tried it. My father gave me soy burgers when I was in high school. I had no idea they were soy. He fried them up, gave them to me. I put the ketchup, mustard, pickle, onion, everything on it. Anybody getting hungry yet? Ketchup, mustard, pickle, onion. Put the bun on top. Took one bite. Something's not quite right with this. This doesn't taste. So that wouldn't be an exact representation, right? That's a poor imitation of something great and something phenomenal. So we're not talking about that. We're not talking about somebody coming along and pretending to be God. That would be a poor imitation. This is the exact representation. And there's a reason why he said it this way, exact, that this is perfect, that which means when you see Jesus, you see God. And when you hear Jesus, you hear God. When you're around Jesus, you are around God. If you want to know what God is like, just look at Jesus. That's one of my biggest issues with the church world, is that one of the things that we must do as followers of Christ is, if we want to know who God is, we must study the life and teachings of Jesus. Why? Because he's God. So get into the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Read about the person of Jesus. Read how he acted. Read how he responded. Read what his attitude was like. Read what his priorities were. And you will be able to come to a conclusion of who God actually is. Now, when he says the exact representation, he says the exact representation of his nature. Something interesting is happening here in the Greek text when we talk about the exact representation of the nature of God. Because nature, as it is interpreted throughout the Greek New Testament, it's quite interesting, because it means confidence. It means assurance. In fact, this is the only time in the New Testament that it's actually translated into the English as nature. If I give you an example, 2 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 4 says, "Otherwise, if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to speak of you, will be put to shame by this confidence." That's the term. 2 Corinthians 11, 17, "What I am saying, I am not saying as the Lord would, but as in foolishness, in this confidence of boasting." That's the word, confidence. Hebrews 3, 14, "For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold fast the beginning of our assurance." That's the word, firm until the end. Hebrews 11, 1, you know this verse, I'm sure. "Now faith is the assurance," that's the word, "of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." So you see, the concept that the writer of Hebrews was getting across was the idea of assurance and confidence. You might ask the same thing I'm asking, what does that have to do with nature? He's the exact representation of his nature, where the term itself could easily be translated as confidence and assurance. Let's just put that in, see what it sounds like. If we change that and put it in, he's the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his confidence. He is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his assurance. What would help us out if we continue to read that verse? He says, "And upholds all things by the word of his power." Confidence and assurance are something interesting, aren't they? Because if there's one thing that we as human beings struggle with, it's those two things. Confidence and assurance. I remember in high school, we were talking with a few friends, and it was pretty much a debate. It really didn't accomplish much, but we had a couple believers like myself and then a couple atheists on the other side, and we're going back and forth. And the one atheist responds, and he says, "I don't believe something unless I see it." And he said, "If he was to zap me off this planet, I certainly would believe." If he would do something and show me, then I would believe. And that kind of reminds us of the rich man and Lazarus when the rich man is in Hades and he's crying out and he's saying, okay, if you can't save me, then please go tell my brothers. I have five brothers and they don't believe. And he said, nope, they have the Moses, they have the prophets, they have the scriptures, let them listen to them. And he said, no, why? Because they won't listen to them because I didn't listen to them. I didn't listen to the scriptures is what the rich man was saying. So they're not going to listen. What did Father Abraham respond with? If they don't believe Moses and the prophets, if they don't believe the scriptures, then they won't believe even if somebody rises from the dead. Assurance and confidence is interesting because I've always, it's very seldom that I've ever run into anybody when we talk about believing in God, that they would say, oh, I believe he's God and I believe he's all powerful, but I'm not gonna serve him. I've heard some, but very few. For the most part, it's always, he hasn't proven himself to me, so I'm not gonna believe. He hasn't made himself known, I'm not gonna believe. There's no confidence or assurance. And that the problem with in our world is, and this isn't anything new, this has been around ever since the fall of man, is that we doubt. We doubt everything, right? Nod your heads, we do. We doubt. We doubt everything. Every promise that somebody makes, yeah, he probably didn't mean that. Every time we're talking to somebody in public and they tell us a story, how many times do you walk away saying, I wonder if that story's really true? I wonder if it really happened that way. Or I wonder if he was just exaggerating just because I happened to be there. Have you ever heard somebody exaggerate a story? See, there's this whole thing about trust and assurance and confidence, but the writer of Hebrews is making it very clear, and he does this all throughout the whole book, especially when he gets to chapters 11 and 12, when we're talking about the faith of everybody else and all the faith that they had. And that's why in 11:1, when he defines faith, as we just read, it is the assurance of things hoped for and the evidence of things not seen. So it isn't an idea of, well, when I see it, I'll believe it. No, when you follow Christ, that isn't how we do this. Well, what do? You have assurance and you have faith in something you don't see. Simple as that. Well, when I see God, I'll believe him. When I see, nope, sorry. That isn't how this works. And the conviction of the writer of Hebrews is so strong, saying that Jesus is the exact representation of his nature, meaning he's the exact representation of his nature, meaning we can have confidence and assurance that he is the one. And that he is the true Christ, the one who was to come. So what does this mean for us then? This gives us confidence and assurance in the truth of who Christ is. Jesus is who he said he is. And because of that, we have confidence in knowing the truth and we have confidence in serving Christ. Even if no one else serves him along with us, we have confidence in knowing that this is true. What else does this do? Well, there's something else that this does that's kind of hidden in this, is the idea of the challenge that is behind this. Because when we have the idea that he is the exact representation of God, that when you look at Jesus, you see God. When Jesus speaks, it's God speaking. Everything that Jesus does is all as God. And we look at his life and his teachings. Many times we've made assumptions, haven't we? I shouldn't say we, I'll say I. I've made assumptions about Jesus. There have been times I made assumptions. Well, they didn't write the whole story about Jesus. I mean, not every second of his life was recorded. So I'm sure that he messed up a few times. And I'm sure he blew it just like I do. So I'm okay, right? I'm sure he blew his temper. I'm sure there was times when he did this and he did that and he fell. We just don't know. They just didn't tell us about those times. That was a different Jesus. And we've had people over the last 20 or so years coming out with books telling us that, haven't we? Let me tell you about the real Jesus, the Jesus they never told you about, the Jesus that isn't in the Bible. Yeah, you think he didn't get married, he got married. Yeah, you think he didn't have a corrupt lifestyle. Yeah, he had a corrupt lifestyle. What is the motivation behind that? The motivation behind that is nobody can walk this earth and be like that. Come on. All of us have corrupt lifestyles. Come on. Jesus was tempted the same way. I mean, I'm sure Jesus lusted. I'm sure he had all these issues, and I'm sure he wasn't as perfect as he's been claimed to be. What is it? We have an issue with perfection, don't we? We don't like perfection. You ever know somebody that pretty much was perfect? Don't they drive you crazy? You're just like, oh my goodness. Man, could you do something wrong, please? Why? We don't have any comfort in looking at somebody else being perfect. We find comfort, though, if somebody else is doing something wrong. Whew. Glad I'm not the only one. They did it too, so I'm good. We're okay now. They're not perfect, I'm not perfect. They're wrong, I'm wrong. But the truth is, the epistles prove what the Apostle Paul wrote, what the writer of Hebrews writes, proves what we have in the Gospels, because there's never a time that any of the epistles, who were the ones who actually met Christ, or at least knew of someone who knew Christ, writing about Christ, they concur and they affirm what we have in the Gospel writings as true, and that that is who Christ is. Because there's never a time the Apostle Paul, or even the writer of Hebrews, or the writer of John, the epistles, says, 1st, 2nd, or 3rd John, says, well, there was that one time you guys didn't know about that Jesus messed up. No, they affirm all the truth that was in the Gospels, which is what? Jesus was perfect. There was never one moment you found him being selfish. Never one second he was thinking about himself. You could wake Jesus up at 2 o'clock in the morning and he's there to serve no matter what. That was his life. That was who he was. And you might say, well, what about when he blew his stack and he overturned the money changers' tables and made a whip out of cords and drove him out of the temple? And hey, he was still perfect when he did that. Well, why is that? Well, because they were disobedient to him. And because of that, he was showing them, this is what this place is to be. This was what the goal was to be. And some would look at that and say, well, that wasn't very Christ-like. Well, it has to be Christ-like because Jesus did it. So what does that tell us? That we have this solid Jesus that we can put our faith and trust in. He walked this earth. He could have fallen into sin, but he didn't. He didn't fall into the temptation. He lived according to how the Father led him. And according to the writer of Hebrews, he was the exact representation of his nature. Now, here's the challenging part for all of us. What did Jesus ask us to do? He asked us to do the same thing.
Well, you can't expect me to be like, I mean, he's the Son of God.
Right, but remember, he gave up all of his godliness, and as we just said, everything he experienced is as if you and I experienced it ourselves. So the parallel is, as followers of Christ, our goal, what we're after here, is that we are to be the representation of him. So that when people see us, they don't see us, they see Jesus. When people hear us talk, they don't hear us talk, they hear Jesus. When people are just around us, they don't just experience us, they experience the presence of Jesus. That when our priorities line up with Jesus' priorities. And wouldn't it be something if somebody, and I've asked you this before, but wouldn't it be something if somebody would confuse you and say, whoa, wait a minute, you remind me so much of Jesus. Are you Jesus by any chance? But the goal that we have throughout the Gospels and the challenge is this whole idea of Christ-likeness. You see, I grew up thinking my whole life that the goal of Christianity was one thing and one thing alone, and that was heaven, and that was eternity. And that was me getting whatever I wanted. And that was me getting to heaven and sitting on the cloud and enjoying life with whatever I desired, whatever I wanted, having servants around me, everything I could possibly have, the best of this, the best of that, the best. That's what I thought it was all about. The main goal was heaven. And when you go through the scriptures and you read verse by verse and word by word, do it through the entire New Testament. How many times are we talking about heaven versus how many times are we challenged to be like Christ? Being challenged to be like Christ wins, let me just tell you. Because the one thing I could never get away from was we can't live selfless here in order to live selfish there. That's not our goal. Our goal is to be like Jesus. So the comfort that we get from this passage is the idea that Jesus is actually who he says he was, and he is the Son of God. He is the radiance of his glory. He is the exact representation of his nature. He's the one that we can have confidence in, and he's the one that we can have faith in, and he also is the one who empowers us to do the same thing. There's an old hymn from a hymn writer wrote years and years ago. I have one supreme desire, that I may be like Jesus. During this Christmas season, we always joke about this. In fact, anybody here that Alexa has something new for this Christmas season? Anybody here know what Alexa is? How many have Alexa? Yeah, they have something new I just saw, if you haven't heard about it yet. They said that if you're at a holiday event, probably with your family, your friends, your in-laws, whoever, and an argument or a debate starts, which you know they never do, right? Whether it's politics, religion, sports, whatever it might be. Alexa has this new skill. You try it out. They did it for this purpose. All you have to do is say, Alexa, change the subject, and Alexa will give you something to talk about. Isn't that amazing? We have a computerized device helping with our conflict management during the holiday season. But during this time, you might encounter situations you don't want to be a part of. You might even encounter people you would rather not see. What's your main goal? Your main goal isn't, well, I'm going to heaven. No, your main goal is, God, may I be Jesus to them. Can I show Jesus to them? And I don't know if it's possible, God, because I'm a mess, but man, would it, if I could be an exact representation of you, then as a result, what would happen? As a result, they may become followers of Jesus as well. Or maybe they're already following Jesus. Well, then this is going to spur them on to draw closer to him. Because that's the objective of all of us. And that is why we serve Jesus. And that's the main goal in serving him. Lord Jesus, we thank you today for your word and for your truth and for everything that you mean to us. We thank you for the confidence. We thank you for the assurance. We thank you that you are who you say you are. We thank you that we can depend on your word for truth. But Jesus, we also thank you for the challenge today, that the idea of being like you isn't just for you, but the idea of being like you is actually for all of us. And this Christmas season, as we are reminded of you being a child and growing up and how you must have lived with pressures, the same pressures that we experience, the same temptations that we experience, and yet you were able to live above every single one. We ask, Jesus, could we do the same thing? Jesus, we ask, could you empower us to do the same thing? Could our main goal in life not be to get what we want out of things, even eternity in heaven, but could our main goal in life simply be, God, I just want to be like you? We ask all these things in your name, the name of Jesus. Amen.